The reading this morning is Picnic Lightning, a poem by Billy Collins. It is possible to be struck by a meteor or a single-engine plane while reading in a chair at home. Pedestrians are flattened by safes falling from rooftops, mostly within the panels of the comics. But still, we know it is possible, as well as a flash of summer lightning, the thermos toppling over, spilling out on the grass. And we know the message can be delivered from within. The heart, no Valentine, decides to quit after lunch, the power shut off like a switch. Or a tiny dark ship is unmoored into the flow of the body's rivers, the brain a monastery defenseless on the shore. This is what I think about when I shovel compost into the wheelbarrow and when I fill the long flower boxes, then press into rows the limp roots of red impatience. The instant hand of death, always ready to burst forth from the sleeve of his voluminous cloak. Then the soil is full of marvels, bits of leaf like flakes off a fresco, red-brown pine needles, a beetle quick to burrow back under the loom. Then the wheelbarrow is a wilder blue, the clouds a brighter white, and all I hear is the rasp of the steel edge against a round stone, the small plants singing with lifted faces, and the click of the sundial as 1 hour sweeps into the next.
In writing about her mother's death on Christmas Day 2008, Megan O'Rourke suggests that a mother is a story with no beginning. This is because a mother was always there from that first moment of our creation in her body. She's a given, part of the fabric of our lives from day one. In my own mom's case, thinking about her story as having no beginning seems especially true. She was adopted and never cared to learn anything about her birth parents, so her beginnings were shrouded in mystery. No one knew the story, not even her. But my mom's story had an ending. It was an ending that we all could see from miles away. And yet, as is common with deaths that ought to have been anticipated, it felt strangely unexpected when it did arrive. This was a little over a year ago that my mom died. Denial, I think, is a powerful and sometimes beautiful thing, and maybe in this case it allowed us to take in only what we could, one little tidbit at a time. It feels to me like it is also impossible to anticipate what the journey through grief is going to be like. Even as my mom went into hospice care, I didn't know what to expect with the now officially deemed inevitable grief to come. This would be the most significant loss in my life to date. How would I respond? What if I don't cry? I even wondered to myself. Maybe because of my work, I've been with so many people in these moments of death or in the aftermath that I've become somehow jaded and I won't find the tears. Who knows? For the record, I did find the tears, and I realized this really wasn't going to be a problem the morning after she died when I had to pull over driving to the supermarket because tears overcame me. So, what has it been like walking through the shadow of the valley of death this past year? Of course, each journey through grief is particular. The death of a child or a spouse or a parent at a much younger age would be a very different experience from losing my mom at the age of 85. In truth, though, I'm sure even my siblings have had different experiences of grief in this past year. Grief is highly individualized. But my experience, it's what I know, and I have no doubt but that it has changed my spiritual journey in some ways I can't even fathom yet. Since part of my work with you is sharing the meanderings of my spiritual journey, I feel called to share this chapter too. But be clear, I don't lift up my experience in any sense as a universal experience of grief. As most of you know, I like to turn to mythology to make sense of things. Mythology gives me pictures and words that describe what's going on in here. And I feel really lucky that I did my sermon series on Greek mythology at the dawn of the last year of my mom's life. That series, and one myth in particular, gave me a mythological framework that has helped me immensely in this journey through grief. I'm not surprised that it would be a Greek myth that was so helpful. Part of the incredible lasting power of Greek mythology is that the stories really capture something significant and moving about death. So the myth that accompanied me this past year is the story of Orpheus and his beloved Eurydice. Just before their wedding, Eurydice is attacked by a satyr. In the struggle, she falls into a nest of vipers, gets bit in the heel, and dies. It is Orpheus who discovers her body. An exquisite musician, Orpheus pours out his bottomless grief in lamentations that are so beautiful. He decides to go to the underworld in hopes of seeing his beloved again. His mournful music softens the hearts of Hades and Persephone. They tell him that he and Eurydice can return to the realm of the living and live forever. There's just one condition, that as they walk through the underworld to the gates back to this world, Eurydice must walk behind Orpheus, and he must not look back at her. If he does, the deal's off. For whatever reason, Orpheus turns, looks at her, and loses her for a second and final time. How many times this year have I felt like Orpheus? I've wanted my loved one back. I just want to see my mom once more. The twinkle in her eye, the smile that tells me that all is well in the world. If I knew how to get to the underworld to fetch her, I just might do it. Sometimes I want her back at predictable moments, like when I call home and after talking to my dad a while, it feels like it's time for him to give the phone over to my mom. I really wish she was with us last fall when the Detroit Tigers, her beloved Detroit Tigers, almost got to the World Series. And I know I'm going to want her back in a couple months when I'm at my nephew's wedding, her oldest grandchild getting married. But sometimes the desire to have mom back with me bursts in at times when I don't really expect it. I'm doing my laundry or driving through Appleton or watching the Packers, and I wish she was with me. Okay, the laundry kind of makes sense. She was a laundry-holic. But the Packers, she liked baseball. She didn't follow football. She could care less. If I'm honest, I have to admit that there have even been times when I thought that my mom's story could have a different ending. Maybe we could flash back to that December of 2010 and find something we missed that would have enabled her to live. Maybe we could go back 5 or 6 years when she fell down in church, going up the stone steps, hit her head, and began her descent down in hell. Maybe we could find a way to prevent that fall from happening. Mom, don't go to church today. Or maybe I could stroll into the underworld, make a deal with the gods, and bring her back. Last summer, I loved and hated reading Joan Didion's book about the year following the death of her husband. She titled the book, The Year of Magical Thinking. She writes that there was a level on which I believed that what had happened remained reversible. The story's ending could somehow have been rewritten. Of course, this makes absolutely no sense, but it makes sense to me now, having walked through the netherworld of grief. Grief makes us think magical, absurd thoughts, and it makes them seem not the least bit far-fetched or outlandish. Grief is a time of magical thinking. There's another level of the story of Eurydice and Orpheus that speaks to me. Megan O'Rourke captures this well. The story of Orpheus, she writes, it occurs to me, is not just about the desire of the living to resuscitate the dead, but about the ways in which the dead drag us along into their shadowy realm because we cannot let them go. So we follow them into the underworld, descending, descending, until one day we turn and make our own way back. That's it. I feel like a lot of this past year, I have been walking in the realm of the dead. I followed my mom there. I could not let her go. It's also certainly true that during this past year, I have been much more viscerally aware of death. Grief pierced that veil of denial that kept me from thinking about the death of loved ones or my own death. I've learned some things this year as I've walked through this valley of the shadow of death. One thing I learned is something that I knew in my heart, but not in my gut, that community really matters. I need family. I need friends. I need a congregation. Community is my lifeblood. My wife's and my kids' loving support this year, friends driving 7 hours for my mom's memorial service, a fellowship member sending me an email welcoming me into the club of sons who have lost their moms, the cards from so many of you. This all helped immensely. One of the amazing moments of the last year was sitting down with an envelope full of handwritten notes from the students in our Lawrence campus ministry. Dissolved in tears, I was so grateful for that gift. It was so healing. So even though at some level walking through this underworld was a solitary journey, I never felt alone. This makes me think a lot about the importance of a congregation in my life. I run into folks without a congregation, or people have come here a while and then quit and say, you know, I don't really need the fellowship. Well, when things are going well, you might not need the fellowship. But things will not always be going well. There'll be a time when you are in the valley of the shadow of death, and you will need a community walking with you, holding you, supporting you. At least that's been my experience. And I think this is all particularly important when we're grieving in this country at this time in our history, because we have largely succeeded in compartmentalizing and privatizing grief. In the old days, all the rituals around death helped surround grieving people with community. It's not the case so much today. The body's whisked away, we have a memorial service, or we don't. And the memorial service, if we have one, is supposed to provide closure. Now, it's time to move on, get back to your life, business as usual, pretend everything's normal. Right. 1 week later, closure. It makes no sense. You are still trudging through the underworld, following your loved one, no map in hand. We need a place where this fiction of closure is not recognized. We need a congregation, I think. I've also learned that grief comes in waves. Sometimes the incoming tide is entirely predictable, like when an anniversary comes up. So this past year, Mother's Day, my mom's birthday, my parents' wedding anniversary, my birthday, the anniversary of mom's going into hospice, the anniversary of her death, these all brought predictable waves of grief. In fact, I actually experienced the lead up to these days to be much more powerful and hard than the days themselves. Anticipation turned out to be the bigger challenge. But then there were these unexpected times when grief crashed in. Joan Didion writes about sudden apprehensions that weaken the knees and blind the eyes and obliterate the dailiness of life. Half the time I had no clue what triggered the onslaught. There's a wariness you develop as a grieving person. You never know if grief will jump out at you around the next corner, taking you back into the underworld. I learned that as a grieving person, I was prone to being tired, distracted, and disoriented. I felt like my energy level was chronically lower than usual. All of this makes sense. It is exhausting trudging through the underworld. It takes an enormous amount of energy. I'm sure Orpheus got tired too. And of course, walking in two worlds at the same time can be enormously disorienting. Life goes on. I had to work. I had to shovel the snow. I had to pay the taxes. I had to show some love to my kids and wife. I couldn't take a time out from this world to solely concentrate on this journey through the underworld. I learned that self-pity is a pretty easy thing to fall into when you're walking through grief. It goes with the territory, I think. Joan Didion, again, puts it well, that when we mourn our losses, we also mourn, for better or for worse, ourselves, as we were, as we are no longer, as we will one day not be at all. Suddenly, I can imagine my son and my daughter lowering my ashes into the earth, and it makes me feel really sorry for myself. I learned that for me, a physical gravesite is important. Maybe it's partly because the ritual of putting my mom's ashes in the earth was so powerful. Maybe it's because the cemetery she's in is so beautiful, it was a snowy, beautiful day, and the family plot with gravestones going back to people who were born and died in the 1800s feels so historic. Whatever the reason, I find it really moving and very sacred to go visit my mom's grave. I'm more convinced now that I want my remains in a place with a marker. And finally, I have learned to treasure more deeply life's sweetness. Loss teaches us not to take for granted the sweetness in life. We learn in our hearts and not just in our heads that nothing lasts forever. Every day a loved one graces our life is a blessing. I fear losing touch with this lesson again, as seems inevitable when the grief becomes less intense, less frequent. We forget what we learned. I don't want to forget what I've learned. I want to remember this lesson when I shovel compost into a wheelbarrow, when I fill the long flower boxes, then press into rows the limp roots of the red impatience. Then I will notice the soil is indeed full of marvels. But the wheelbarrow is a wilder red. My wheelbarrow's red. Billy Collins is blue. But the clouds are a brighter white. But alas, there does come a day when we stop following our loved one in the underworld. There comes a day when we turn back and we rejoin the world of the living. Even then, the remnants of grief can pull us back into the underworld, but usually only briefly. The trajectory of our lives is back above the ground, not below. And maybe it's not a particular moment when we turn and make our way back into this realm. Maybe it's a gradually dawning awareness that we're back. Whatever the case, I suspect that we really don't know when that moment or that season is, except in hindsight. So looking back on this year of my grief, a particular dream I had stands out as a milestone. It was a marker that my time following my mom in the underworld, my dead mom, was about over. I don't remember for sure even when the dream was, but it was very, very vivid. I was communicating in the dream with my mom. She was dead, but like that magical world of Harry Potter, she could speak or interact from a portrait. So I was looking at this portrait of her, and she couldn't talk, but she could use sign language. So she lifted up her craggy fingers, and though my mom never knew sign language as far as I knew, she signed to me, "I love you." And that, it turns out, is all I needed to know. I could let her go now. I could turn and make my way back into the realm of the living. A poem by Carla Bonoff. A life so fragile, a love so pure, we cannot hold on, but we try. We watch how quickly it disappears, and we'll never know why. But I'm okay now. Goodbye, my friend. You can go now. Goodbye, my friend.